In a lot of ways, this narrative could really zip along, and we could go, okay, yeah, it's a cool story. Great for flannel graphs and the like. I don't have a flannel graph here today, I'm sorry. Could have drawn pictures on the board. But sometimes as we read through stuff like this, it's hard for us to just stop and meditate and glean God's lessons. I mean, why does he go into this big storm and such? I mean, just say, okay, we were shipwrecked on Malta and the like. So we'll try and slow down a little bit as we essentially race ourselves across the Mediterranean Sea. I am not going to make somebody read this because of all the names here of strange and peculiar places. First verse is okay. Somebody want to read the first verse? For the most part.
And when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, centurion of Augustus' band.
Good. Okay, what we're going to see here is Luke gives us, as we go through this first section, really just the facts, kind of Joe Friday-esque here, boom, boom, boom. He's going to just tell you what's going on, what's happening, without a lot of embellishment, and that's a lot of times Luke's way here. So it was decided that we should sail for Italy. If you want to travel to San Francisco, how hard would it be for you to travel to San Francisco? Assuming you had the money.
Well, even if you had the money, you could walk it.
Well, you could, yeah, okay. That might take a while.
Months.
You could actually walk to Rome, too, but that would take a lot longer. I mean, if you wanted to go to San Francisco, when could you be there? Today. You could be there today. Probably have to drive to Dallas. I'm sure you could procure a flight to San Francisco this afternoon. You'd probably be there by 3 or 4 o'clock if you left right now. I mean, it's a prominent place. So to get there is easy. Now, if you're in Caesarea, along the Mediterranean coast here, and you're wanting to go to Rome, like way across the map, here, even down further, it spans the whole slide all the way up in the upper left-hand corner is Rome. Dude, back in that day, it's going to take time. And so Paul has appealed to Caesar. Paul's got to get to Rome, and so we've got to get a ship. And it's not just for Paul. Paul is a prisoner, and so he's going to have an escort. And probably not going to do it just for one guy. Let's wait until we've got a group and kind of send the mass all at once there. And ultimately we see that there are other prisoners here, and it's a centurion that is taking him. So there's a great responsibility. And we see he is of a particular cohort, just like if we go back and look at Cornelius in Acts chapter 10, Cornelius was also a centurion in Caesarea. Cornelius was of the Italian cohort, where here Julius is the Augustan cohort. Okay. Did Julius know Cornelius? Maybe. Had Cornelius shipped out at that time? Had he been reassigned? Don't know. So it's going to take time. So they finally find a ship heading that way with enough space for all these people on board, and they put out. And embarking in a ship of Adramidium, okay, that is the where it's normally ported, a ship of Adramidium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. So we, at the very least, Luke is with Paul, the we in there, and Aristarchus. And we will see a little bit later that Aristarchus may actually be a prisoner with Paul. I mean, he may be in chains with Paul at this time. Let me move this up just so there's a little, I'm sorry for the weak printing. If you look way up at the top, I'll point over here. Adramidium is actually right over there. And talked about sailing along the coasts. Typically, a smaller ship is going to sail along the coasts. Why? Because it's not going to be able to handle the rough waves out on the open sea. So it's not typically going to be cutting across, taking the shortest distance between two points here. Also, there was a lot of wheat trade in the Roman Empire, and it may have been simply a wheat ship at that time, cargo ship that was taking stuff from port to port. Anyway, Aristarchus, have we heard about this guy in the past? Familiar name? Huh? It does. If you flip back to Acts chapter 19, and this is in the middle of the riot in Ephesus, verse 28, when they heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." So the city was filled with confusion. They rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians who were Paul's companions in travel. So this is, again, oftentimes Luke will introduce a guy simply by dropping him into the story here because he's going to be a player a little bit later on. At the start of chapter 20 also, as we are getting the entourage together to take the offering of the Macedonians, okay, the whole Grecian peninsula there had an offering set to bring back to Jerusalem to the church that was in need there. And in the listing of individuals who are joining Paul in going back in verse 4, we have Sopater, the Berean, son of Pyrrhus, accompanied him, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus and Secundus, and Gaius of Derbe. So there we have indication, anyway, that Aristarchus was a faithful traveling companion of Paul. Which brings to mind, when we think of Paul, we think of Paul as a giant in the mission field. We think of Paul doing the missionary work. Did Paul
do it all by himself?
No. Yeah. No. And it's important for us not to lose sight of that. You know, as we read through these powerful letters, high and vaulting letters. Paul's letter to the Romans, essentially written during this season that we have passed through already. Many of Paul's letters already written. And you see the people who are with him, supporting him. Ministry does not happen in one man. It doesn't. There is a church. There is a body around. Even as he's traveling, he has his support team with him. As we finished Colossians, almost a year ago now, one of the last sections, we read that Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, greets you. So is that euphemistic? You know, is he just a prisoner, captive, bondservant of the Lord, or is he in fact in chains with Paul? And considering he's going along here on this trip, and we see that there are other prisoners, it might well be that Aristarchus is with him as a prisoner. All right, the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. So they head out from Caesarea
down here just to the northwest of Jerusalem, and they just
bounce up the coast, not very far, stop in Sidon for the night, for the day, offload, onload. And what do we see about Paul's relationship with Julius here?
He's cordial.
Yeah.
Trustworthy, too.
Okay. Is this different? Is this any different than really what we have seen in Paul's last 2 years, two plus years from his incarceration in Jerusalem? Things started out pretty rough, but they changed when? When did that whole treating him like a brute prisoner change to more of a white collar?
When they found out he was a Roman.
Yes. Okay, again, Paul's Roman citizenship is well known here. Apparently he has continued to be essentially an upstanding and model prisoner. There he's not been a stinker to the Romans, hasn't been a thorn in their side, and so they have paid him really every courtesy there and given him great liberties and great freedoms. We saw that under Felix, we saw that under Festus as well, and Julius here is continuing that. Now, in truth, we know little about the church in Sidon, other than that there is one there now. And it's just a sweet thing to go up and see the believers there and to be cared for by them. It is very likely that those on the ship, especially those who are passengers, you know, you're going to have to pay your own way. And that the church would be able to be a blessing for those who are traveling. Have you ever had a friend who you knew? I mean, Wichita Falls, we're off the beaten path. The only people that really come through here is if they're traveling from the west toward the DFW area. And they hit Amarillo and they circuit down 287. But have you ever had somebody drive through town, not stop, and you learn later that they drove through town and they didn't contact you? It's like, oh man, I would have loved to have seen them. Oh, that would have been great. Or have you been someplace where you visited a new church, maybe you were just there for the weekend, went in, and people were extremely kind to you, and all of a sudden there's a kinship and a fellowship there that you never had before, a friendship that is cultivated really because of your relationship with Jesus Christ. And so they are savoring that sweet fellowship there in Sidon. As we go through here, Acts chapter 27 is really historically a rich chapter, especially from a nautical perspective. If you're a sailor, Navy man, I'm sure they would get all salivating at this, to hear about the historical waterways and how they crossed over. So a lot of the stuff we go through kind of bounces off most Air Force guys here. But very interesting. So they put out to sea from Sidon in verse 4, and they sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. What's that mean? We sailed under the lee of Cyprus. Is that like going under the branches?
It sounds like a current.
Port and starboard. Good, Air Force guy. Well done.
But it is a nautical term. Right?
It is a nautical term. Lee means what?
In the shadow of.
Essentially, you've got the weather side, the side that the weather is hitting you on, and the lee side is that's protected. Downwind, essentially, is what Air Force guys would say. On the downwind side. Of it.
It sounds like they're using the vacuum.
Okay, so what they do from Sidon, rather than cutting across the shortest distance between two points to these other ports over here, they go the long way around because the wind was against them. Okay, was essentially a westerly at this point, and so to go around Cyprus is going to lead to less bucking the headwind there, and likely calmer waters in between Cyprus and Asia Minor as they cross around. So that's free. So from that point, they sail across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia. We came to Myra in Lycia, and you can see it up there on the map. There, the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. Okay, so how long are they there? We don't know. This is not happening this afternoon. There's time. What's going on ship during this whole time? But days and weeks are passing, essentially, to get up there from Myra. And ultimately now they have a big enough ship to make way. Ship from Alexandria. Alexandria is down here, close to Egypt. Very prominent city for the Romans at that time. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off of... Anybody want to try that one? It's like they dropped a vowel. Someone? Conitus? We'll go with Conitus. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete off of Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. Okay? So again, they're heading out to sea and going, we're not... Again, shortest distance between two points would be to shoot between Achaia and Crete here. But they're going, we're not... Winds are not letting that happen, so... You go with the wind here. Go with God's direction. You go where God leads you to go. And so they end up putting out to sea, heading down toward Crete. Again, the lee side of Crete. The winds are strong this way. And here is Lycia along the southern coast of Crete. Now, if you'll notice, you can maybe make it out. There's a little peninsula right there on the south end of Crete. Almost looks like an appendix, or the hook echo that you would look for on clouds on the weather radar where the tornadoes would show up. So it looks a lot like that. So at this point, really, we're heading to Rome. Life's good. Not much going on. Much time had passed, though, verse 9 tells us, and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over. Okay, the fast would be the Day of Atonement. It is fall. It is fall. Winter is fast approaching. Apparently, you did not sail across the big parts of the Mediterranean in the wintertime. Bad. Not good. Storms were sudden, and the winds were unpredictable. So, they would typically not. And here Paul speaks up. And you kind of wonder who really is in charge at this point. Paul speaks up and says, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." The centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. Okay. Who's Paul? Yeah. Noted. Thank you. Why does Paul even think to speak up here?
It seems like he's knowledgeable of the seas.
Or that the Lord had given him some kind of...
Typically, we will read that is the case. And it doesn't say that here. Yet.
He was a fisherman, actually.
Tent maker.
Tent maker.
Yeah. But in his travels to this point, first, second, third missionary journey, he spent some time on boats. Okay? And you can see here at the end of the third missionary journey, they cut across the open sea, and it takes time. And Paul, I mean, Paul, you would think of Paul as a Renaissance man, okay? If something was happening, he'd probably want to go, hey, tell me all about it. You know, what's going on? He'd be right there with the captain going, how are you doing? What are you, you know, how's it all working out? As opposed to just idling his way, sitting on the stern of the ship, watching the wake go past. So it appears that Paul had some knowledge, and he simply offered up a, probably don't want to do this. Now, if a prisoner's going, hey, let's not go, what might you be thinking?
Stalling.
Yeah, exactly. And again, noted, go away. There. But the pilot, the captain of the ship, and the owner of the ship, who apparently was on board as well, went, no, we need to get this cargo, perhaps, to Rome. I don't know that the prisoners were urgent, but whatever was on the boat was worth taking off. Now, Lycia apparently was not a very good harbor, not suitable for the winter. They decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete. So they want to go from Lycia, again on that peninsula around here, around that little appendix, that point of land, to Phoenix along the southwestern shore. Interesting that Luke would note that the harbor there faces both southwest and northwest, and spend winter there. And I go, but apparently that is in fact the case of Phoenix, it also having kind of a peninsular projection out of it. So life's good. The south wind blew gently. Supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Okay. And away they went. Now, before we get into things going badly, Paul is speaking up in an area where he is not an expert. Okay? He's a tent maker, he's a theologian, he's a minister of the gospel. But he feels it necessary to speak up. Are there situations that we face today that are like that? That we can face as believers today where we are not an expert, but we need to speak up. And are you going to get slapped down because you are not a sailor? Example.
Wait, are we talking just general advice or?
Situations that we would face as Christians where we would have to say, well, this is right or this is good or this is what we should do. And they go, you know, who are you? Okay, abortion. Why do you have no say?
I'm not a doctor.
Okay, you're not a doctor. Why else do you have no say?
You're not the one who's dealing with
it. Uh-huh, exactly. What do you know? You don't know my situation. It's my body.
You're not a woman.
Oh, yeah, you guys, you. You know what? You have no authority on which to speak. Here's another big one, gender. Gender issues. I just received this week a PowerPoint presentation on the Air Force. Yeah, to talk about that all of the troops were supposed to get with regard to gender training in the Air Force. And it was very interesting that the commander would have to abide the airman's gender situation if a medical doctor stated that there was a need for gender reassignment. That a medical doctor would have to declare a need for gender reassignment. And what would you say to that?
Yes, sir, 3 bags full.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, but to, are you a medical doctor? If Dr. Chris says, Stephanie, really, she's wanting to be a man, and she needs it. What do we say?
We define the word need.
Yeah. Need. Okay, my heart stopped beating. I need a chest massage. Please. But you paddles. That I need. I'm bleeding out because of a bullet wound. I need a tourniquet. That is what I need.
I was thinking also someone who's suicidal. Like someone that looks like they have the obvious sign of suicide. If you want to confront that person and say, hey, I'm really concerned about you because, you're depressed a lot lately. You don't want to go up and say, I think you might kill yourself, but you're going up there to that person saying, what's going on? You might get shut away and say, what are you, a psychiatrist now? Or
yeah. And supervisors might say, hey, you're not a psychological professional in that situation. And you have the words of life. You have the words of life. And you have the words of truth. And so you may not be an expert. But we have to speak up. We have to speak up. And you're going to be shot down. You are going to be slapped down. And we will see Paul gets ultimately vindication in this. And you will get vindication. Maybe not in this life, but certainly in the next. A commendation from the Lord for speaking the truth at a time where you could have been cowed and just not said anything and gone your way. All right, so off they go. Life's great, south wind blows, verse 13. They weighed anchor, sailed along creek close to the shore. Bum, bum, bum. Minor chord change in verse 14. But soon a tempestuous wind called the northeaster struck down from the land. So the wind had pretty much been on their noggin here, coming in this way, and all of a sudden it shifts from the northeast and comes down as they head around the point. I don't know if there's higher terrain here along the southern edge or the eastern edge of Crete there, and kind of opens up to make a funnel across the bay there, and it just smacks them hard. The Greek word that Luke uses is typhonicus, from which we get typhoon. Okay, huge circular wind comes down and smacks them hard. And the ship's caught and could not face the wind. I mean, it could not even get itself turned around to buck into the wind. The wind was so strong it ultimately going to push against them. So it's like, okay, man. It's like, okay, let's just give way to the force here that is pushing against us. And they were driven along. They are running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, which sits just off of Crete here. You can see that they are being pushed. Instead, they're trying to head up to Phoenix to the northwest. They're heading southwest. Okay, 90 degrees off of the way they want to go. They come across Cauda. They're under the lee. And so they get just a brief respite here under Cauda. They secured the ship's boat. Now, some of this stuff, even the experts, they would argue, what do they mean? What do they mean by this? Is this just kind of the dinghy that they used to put into shore, sitting alongside? Is it normally hanging out in the water there? Was it hanging off the side, kind of beating against the boat? That's open for debate. So they hoisted it up, so that would lead you to believe it was in the water beside them, just for going to and fro. They used supports to undergird the ship. Okay, so bad are the seas that they're like trying to hold the thing together. They're running supports, probably very big ropes under the ship, and securing it somehow across the top just to... Let's put some duct tape on this whole thing. It's that bad. So they undergird it. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. Again, I know nothing about the Syrtis, but experts say the Syrtis is Scylla and Charybdis. You ever hear the term between a rock and a hard place? Anybody know your Greek mythology? Scylla and Charybdis. Up there where the toe of Italy meets Sicily, very narrow passage. And the whirlpool, I believe the whirlpool was Charybdis and the beast was Scylla. So would create a whirlpool in the water, and you'd have to kind of get around the whirlpool, and you'd have to get close to the rocks. If you got too close to the rocks, it would beat you to pieces. So between a rock and a hard place is actually the region between Sicily and Italy there. Well, like that, Syrtis apparently is some heinous sandbars and rocky shoals along the north coast of Africa that was like, you don't go near Syrtis. Okay, bad place to go. And they thought, with the winds coming hard out of the northeast, that they were going to be driven right along to Syrtis. So fearing that they would run aground on it, they lowered the gear and thus were driven along. Okay. So bad situation. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. Okay, let's lighten the load. Lighten the load so that the seas don't batter us as hard. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. What specifically that means, too, is unclear. But ultimately, they are getting rid of all the weight they don't need. Everything is going overboard. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and no small tempest lay on us, it just kept coming. All hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Hopeless situation. They'd been without food for a long time. Verse 21, Paul stood up and said, "Men, you should have listened to me." Okay. Is there a time to say, "I said this would happen"? Is that usually well received? No. But sometimes you need to be looked in the eye and said, "You knew this would happen." "Yes, I did." David and Paul, or David and Nathan, "You are the man." Yeah. "You knew better. Should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in the God, in God, that it will be exactly as I have been told, but we must run aground on some island. Okay.
And the sailors were liking it up until that last sentence.
Yeah, whoa, hey. Oh, we're going to be so, whoa, hey. So Paul, now we see, does get a specific prophecy, and it is just that previous night that God says, hey, it's going to be fine. Is that a source of peace?
Yes, for yourself, for the people.
You'd like to think it would have been a source of peace for the guys, to a point. Okay, to a point. Why to a point?
Because they're going to be unpaid. They're going to have nothing.
Well, they already have nothing. They've been dismantling the ship as they go along. Here, they're just trying to save themselves and what's left of the boat. Maybe restock it here later. But they're still in the middle of the storm. And man, you're still getting the tar beat out of you here. And some guy says it's going to be all right. And you go, well, that's great. When? You know, when? Okay, good. That's good. But here we still are. And this, for us as believers, this is what the Word of God is for us oftentimes. Sometimes we really don't even want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. Dude, don't tell me all things work together for good for those who love God and are the called according to His purpose. Yes, I know that. Well, cling to it. I mean, even in the midst of your house being destroyed, it's all I've got. It's all I've got. I'm in misery and I'm still crying. I'm bawling my eyes out. This isn't getting any better, but I hope. I have hope in the God who promises. And again, in this life, we may not see the resolution. We may not see all the threads of the tapestry and all of those analogies that we know because we've heard them over and over again in the Christian life. But they're true. They're absolutely true. If God stands before Paul and says, this is going to take place, it's going to take place. But bad things are still going to happen while all of this unfolds. And so really cling to those truths. I mean, cling to the truths that you know. Cling to the promises that God has made because He loves you and does not want you to lose hope. He does not want you to lose hope. The 14th night had come. So they were driven across the Adriatic. The Adriatic is the sea in between Italy and Greece there. So they're, yeah, I don't even know where they are. They haven't seen, we just know that the wind is
in the right direction.
Indeed, they haven't seen the stars to navigate off of. Did they have a magnetic compass at that time? I don't know when that was introduced. Forgive my history on that. So they likely have no idea other than very likely that they're essentially going in the same direction, going across the Adriatic. About midnight, the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. How would they know that?
Probably waves.
Yeah, they're sailors, you know. They're sailors. They feel the sea. Okay, it feels like we're getting shallower. The sounds get different. And so we may be nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms, 120 feet, 6 feet per fathom. How do they take a sounding? Huh?
A rope.
Yeah, a rope. rope with a weight on it. Throw it out there, throw it out in front. I mean, as the ship's moving to kind of, so as it comes by and you go, okay, now it's slack, boom, that's it. That's, you know, and you factor the, so they can see. The rope's all marked, 120 fathoms. A little further on, they took sounding again, found 15 fathoms. Woohoo! Fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 boat anchors, okay, probably sea anchors to cause drag from the stern, and prayed for day to come. As the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea, so the dinghy gets lowered back down under the pretense of laying out anchors from the bow. Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Okay, Paul, the guy who was like, eh, go away, dude, now tells the centurion, these guys need to not go down there. They have to stay on the big boat here. And the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. All right. Who's now in charge? Paul is now in charge. Paul the prisoner. Paul the prisoner is now in charge. They're taking orders from Paul. How important is it for you to speak up? It's important for you to speak up. You know, ultimately, your speaking up may lead to you having a greater voice in the future because you were the only one who made that stand at that time. Everybody else said you were bananas. You were a Fruit Loop. But you were the one who stood. Paul's declaration to them is, this is what God has said, and I trust my God. I trust my God. Do we trust our God enough to speak about such things? Day dawned, Paul urged them all to take some food. Today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. So they've just been working hard. And, I mean, they're probably down to very little food, and so they're preserving what's left. And Paul says, it's the day. It's time for you to take some food. For it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you. Again, great encouragement. When he had said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and he broke it. He was unashamed to pray before them, and he began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all 276 persons in the ship. Down below it says some manuscripts say 76. Okay, debatable on the size of the ship. When they had eaten enough and lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. That's it. We got nothing left. There's nothing. When it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So, let's go, man. We're making for the beach. We know this is all we've got anymore. They got rid of the anchors, threw them into the sea, loosened the ropes that tied the rudders, hoisting the foresail to the wind. They made for the beach, but they hit a reef. Okay, here we go. Here's our hope. And so we hit a reef, and we're now stuck on a reef. The waves continue to batter us. It starts to destroy the ship. And now it's time to abandon ship. So anybody who could swim, they end up blitzing into the sea and swimming for shore. If you couldn't, you grabbed something on which to float and headed in. But the soldiers, I mean, they got prisoners on board. And they're now going to land. And they've really got nothing left. So how are we going to keep up with the prisoners? So the soldiers were just going to kill them, lest any of them should swim away and escape. But the centurion again honored Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard and make for land. The rest grabbed a plank or a piece of the ship, and so it was they were all brought safely to land. God's great provision for all of them. And you know, what do we gather from this? Obviously, God is sovereign in all of this. God is sovereign in the directions that even the wind blows. God cares for us, obviously, in the midst of the storms in which we find ourselves. as God cared not only for Paul, but he also cared for all the godless Romans that were on board too, because he put them under Paul's care and protection. They were under the umbrella of Paul's protection. Paul had a responsibility to speak up. And so for me, as I read this, even though I'm not an expert in so many things, in this time and culture in which we live, in which everything that is good is now bad, and everything that is bad and evil is now good and exalted, we have a responsibility to speak. Sometimes it may be within our own families, just our own families. And it's going to cause division, and who are you to say these things? I am just a man, but I have the Word of God that says these things. And I, as Paul says, I trust the God whom I serve. And really, it's Him that I proclaim and declare to you when I speak. So speak. God has brought each of us to this time and this place in Wichita Falls on Ethan Travis on this day for His purpose and His glory. And some are going to go back to Lubbock, and some back to Colorado, and some to Japan, and some to D.C. And God has a plan and a purpose. So you speak. It's the Spirit's job ultimately to convince. It's not yours. It's the Spirit's job to convince. So as we speak, we continue to lavish grace and kindness and ministry even when others defy and mock us. And we lavish grace and kindness and ministry. Paul didn't go fine and just go sit in the back of the ship. I mean, he continued to interact with them. And even when he said, hey, I told you guys to stay, however, the God whom I serve hasn't left us, hasn't abandoned us. You know, when we are mocked by others, it's important, lastly, that we consider Christ. I mean, if they're going to mock the God who created the universe and created the cosmos, they're going to mock you too. It's okay. Consider yourselves blessed and honored to suffer as Christ suffered. You guys got any thoughts or comments on this? More of an adventure chapter than deep doctrine?
You know, with Paul, it kind of makes me, just the way he interacts and the way he speaks up and kind of how you've drawn that out makes me think of the story of the Good Samaritan. You know, the guy that got beat up, there was a need there, and all the people that were maybe qualified to minister to him, you know, the Levite and the priest that had maybe all the background that should have, you know, given them the propensity to exercise God's love for this guy, didn't. And, you know, the Samaritan comes along and he has, you know, zero reason to care for this guy at all, but he does. And obviously Jesus is teaching about who your neighbor is. And as Paul speaks up to these guys on the ship, it makes me think of, you've probably heard the saying, no one cares how much you know until they know how much you care. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure at the end of the story, the sailors and the other prisoners and the Romans and the centurion realize, hey, that guy Paul maybe doesn't know anything about, you know, sailing ships, but he cares about us and right. His God cares about us. And I'm sure that was a huge testimony to those guys that he, you know, followed that through, you know, and you know, encouraging them, staying up, say, hey, don't lose heart. We're going to make it out of this. My God has showed me that we're not going to lose a hair of our head. Here, take some food, be encouraged. And the guys are like, okay, he cares. You know, maybe he doesn't know anything personally, but his God cares about us.
How many of those guys will we meet in heaven that were on that ship there? Started out as pagans, but now went, hey, maybe this God is the God, because it happened exactly as Paul said. Excellent. Thanks.
I'm going to be giving a workshop at a homeschool conference next month about military service. And this is a great example of how God used someone in the military, used Julius for God's plan and purpose. And that, you know, he was serving in the military and he was at the right time, at the right place to be used of God.
Sweet. over time. You're dismissed.
Okay.